President Obama's economic policies command the support of virtually every truly distinguished economist in the nation, except that they don't. Economist John Taylor of Stanford University and the Hoover Institution on Uncommon Knowledge from Washington, D.C., now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge, now appearing on the website of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Peter Robinson. John Taylor earned his undergraduate degree in economics from Princeton and his doctorate degree in economics from Stanford. Before joining the Stanford faculty, he taught economics at Princeton and Columbia. One of his most notable academic achievements, the development of what has come to be known as the Taylor Rule, which demonstrates how the Federal Reserve should adjust interest rates to keep the dollar stable and the economy growing. Outside academia, Dr. Taylor served as a senior economist on the Council of Economic Advisors for President Ford and President Carter, and as a member of the Council of Economic Advisors under President George H.W. Bush. From 2001 to 2005, Dr. Taylor served as Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs. The author of a number of books, Dr. Taylor's most recent volume is entitled First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. John Taylor, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Segment one, A Tale of Two Recoveries. Recession one, the early 1980s. The United States suffers a deep recession. By the end of 1982, unemployment reaches a peak of 10.8%. Recovery begins in July of 83. Recession two, the financial sector falls into turmoil, and late 2007, the United States enters once again a deep recession. In October 2009, unemployment reaches its peak of, this time, 10%. In June 2009, the economy once again begins to grow or expand. John, briefly, if you would, compare the recovery of the 80s with the recovery that we're experiencing today. Chart number one, growth.
The recovery in the 1980s was so much more rapid and so much stronger. And this chart shows you that. It shows how we basically, it came down in the recession and then started to grow, but very, very slowly in this recent recovery. It's hardly picking up relative to potential GDP.
Employment.
Well, employment's even more striking. If you look at the fraction of the working age populations actually working, it's actually declined in this recovery, where it just went like gangbusters in the 1980s recovery. Many, many more jobs were created in that recovery from the recession.
And then what actually is versus what might have been, the chart, the potential versus real GDP?
The chart with potential and real GDP shows how in this recovery we haven't even kept pace with our overall potential of the economy. The red line shows you potential growing at a relatively steady pace. We came down in that recession and just really haven't closed the gap at all. Still
and
very low.
The potential GDP is based on what?
It's based on a trend, measures of your productivity, labor force, basically what the economy is capable of producing. This one's estimated by the Congressional Budget Office.
Okay, so what we have here is two sharp recessions, and in the 1980s, the economy rebounds dramatically.
It's a 6% growth compared to 2% in this one.
And today it's a very sluggish recovery. I want to get to detailed policy analysis, but for a layman, can you sum up in two sentences the difference between the recovery in the 80s and the recovery today?
Well, it's like night and day. One thing, the recovery back then was based on an economy which was booming. It came out, it was a very deep recession. It came out, it was booming. Growth was 6%, if you like. And this one, it's much slower, 2% or so. So unemployment has remained high, unlike the previous one. Fewer jobs are being created. Incomes aren't growing. Just you name it, it's much, much more disappointing and very unusual, quite frankly.
Okay, so let's go, if we could, to an analysis of what President Obama has attempted to do to promote growth, to get this sluggish recovery into something more like the 1980s vigorous recovery. A segment two, the stimulus. Let's just take the Stimulus Act, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, also known as the Obama stimulus, some $800 billion, almost all of it intended to be spent within the first 3 years. As I understand it, most of it was spent within the first 3 years, but there's a long tail involved. How did it work?
I don't think it worked very well at all. It was disappointing compared to the many forecasts that people had. It was actually fairly close to what I thought would happen. The money that was sent to people to spend, largely they saved it, they didn't spend it. The money that was sent to the states so that they could build infrastructure projects, they largely put it away. They didn't build infrastructure projects. So it was very disappointing in terms of stimulating the economy.
Economist Paul Krugman. Krugman supported the law, but he criticized it for the stimulus for being too small. I have a quotation here. He said that it did not, quote, even cover one-third of the spending gap, close quote. So you, of course, agree with Paul Krugman that the problem with the stimulus was not that it was too big, but that it was too small.
No, I don't agree. I agree it didn't work, but for completely different reasons. If you think about it, if it was three times as big, it wouldn't have made much more difference anyway. Plus, in that case, we would have had even a more significant debt problem than we have now. And we have so much evidence from earlier in our history about these things not working. Peter, it's not just this one. These things didn't work.
George W. Bush tried a smaller stimulus.
Smaller one, it didn't work. Same kind of thing. People saved the money. But even go back further, go back into the 70s, we tried these kinds of policies and they didn't work. Stimulus programs to the states and to consumers.
Okay, now you mentioned debt. We've been talking about the specific stimulus package shortly after President Obama came into office, but there's a kind of underlying classic Keynesian effort that runs throughout the Obama time in office of deficit spending. President Obama comes into office, the national debt's about $10.5 trillion. It's risen to well over $15 trillion now. He's added roughly 50% to the national debt. How has that worked?
Well, it makes it more appropriate than ever to try to undo a lot of these things, to get the spending explosion back down so we contain the debt. But it's more than the debt. It's these temporary actions. The stimulus package, remember we had something called cash for clunkers.
Right.
We were given a bit of money to buy a new car. We had first-time home buyers. We had a temporary reduction in the payroll tax. A whole lot of, if you like, temporary things. And as I say, we've known for a long, both based on history, based on experience, based on economic theory, theorists like Milton Friedman, that these temporary interventions just don't get the economy moving.
John, on this question of deficit spending, I'm going to go on to monetary policy in a moment, but on deficit spending, President Obama's added a huge amount to the debt. We know that. But so did Ronald Reagan. Reagan came in, the debt was $700 billion. By the time he left office, it was $2 trillion. In percentage terms, he added much more to the national debt than did Barack Obama. So what's the correct way of understanding the Reagan debt deficit spending?
Well, I think that's why I emphasize this temporary thing to these policies. They just don't get the economy moving. In the case, Reagan didn't have short-term stimulus packages. He had a long-term tax reform, reduction in tax rates. You didn't have this kind of stop-go policy in general. You had a more steady policy. And in addition, in a recession, tax revenues fall and spending goes up generally on the welfare programs, unemployment insurance. So you always have a deficit increase in a recession. You want it to be temporary and when the economy gets moving again.
So there's an automatic kind of self-correcting.
Yes, automatic stabilizers, economists call it sometimes. And so you wouldn't want to raise taxes in a recession, right? That would be a terrible policy. And so what you try to do is let the deficit swing, but get it back down again so that when you're growing and the economy is back to full employment, you have got the deficit back to zero.
Monetary policy. Let me just go through this fast. Since 2007, the Federal Reserve, under Chairman Bernanke, has engaged in unprecedented efforts. They've kept the short-term rates close to zero since December 2008. Engaged in three rounds of so-called quantitative easing, during which the Fed has acquired more than $2 trillion in government debt and mortgage-backed securities. Late last year, the Fed announced that it would hold interest rates at close to zero as long as unemployment remained above 6.5%, which it does to this day substantially. What's good about this? What is bad about this? Do you want to write it all off? Has the Fed's policy been misguided since the financial crisis?
I think in the panic, their actions were good. Before the panic, leading into it, their policy was too easy, if you like. It caused a surge for yield, it caused the boom.
Under Chairman Greenspan?
Yes, also Bernanke for a while. But the actions during the panic in the fall of 2008, I think, made a lot of sense. But since then, starting in 2009, all the things you just mentioned, I think, have been counterproductive, quite frankly. It's not so much the interest rate at zero, it's these quantitative easing things you mentioned, which are massive purchases of Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities.
Walk me through, treat me like an idiot child, John. during the financial crisis, it was correct to flood the markets with liquidity to do what? To keep the financial system itself intact.
Yes.
And operating.
Well, central banks have a role, lender of last resort, that when there's a panic, they provide liquidity. And they did that actually when the physical damage occurred back in 9/11, 2001. They put funds in. They did it in the fall of 2008. So that's good. It's reasonable.
But the actions,
then you remove it. Right. Basically, it's like sometimes we call it liquidity, short term. When the panic is over, you remove that liquidity. And a lot of those so-called facilities, those short-term lending facilities they put in at that point, did draw down. But what the Fed did is they then went in and purchased many other securities.
So the aim of the Fed changed. At first, it's attempting to keep the financial system up and operating. But ever since, it's been trying to promote economic growth.
Absolutely, they're trying to keep interest rates low,
right,
to stimulate borrowing, to stimulate demand, to get the economy moving. Since the recovery has been slow, and it's actually much slower than they forecast, they've been doing more and more. So as the economy slowed, they intervene more. The intervention hasn't seemed to pick up the economy, so it's really accumulated, and so now they're on a track to have even more intervention.
John Taylor in the Wall Street Journal, quote, "At the very least, the Fed's policy creates a great deal of uncertainty. People recognize that the Fed will eventually have to sell the assets it has been purchasing to prevent inflation," close quote. Okay, so there's uncertainty because everybody knows this can't continue with that much money sloshing around. Inflation is bound to kick in. But we've had 5 years now of inflation at only about 2%. Where is the inflation?
I don't think it's but. We've always emphasized that there's a two-sided risk with this.
Mm-hmm.
People, if the money is not pulled out fast enough, there'll be inflation. If it's pulled out too fast, it'll slow down the economy because there's all this uncertainty. So it's two-sided. And so I think that risk, that uncertainty, is what's held the economy back. When you have a very high unemployment rate, slow economic growth, you don't have these pressures on inflation. So it's not surprising. Inflation will pick up if they don't make the correction. But they may make the correction too rapidly, in which case we'll have like a double dip, if you like. So it's a two-sided risk. I can't emphasize that enough.
All right. And while we're on monetary policy, just one more question from this layman. As I said, treat me as an idiot child. But the argument runs as follows. We spend about 25% of the federal government spends about 25% of GDP and takes in about 21%. And that gap has been made up in recent years basically by borrowing from China and by the Federal Reserve. And so if you are sitting over there at the Federal Reserve and you say, if we tighten up, wait a minute, the President of the United States has made a decision to pursue certain fiscal policies, and if we tighten up the money supply, we will be undermining the duly elected chief executive of this country and his Treasury Secretary and his carefully calibrated economic policies.
The role of monetary policy should not be to bail out fiscal policy, not to make it easier to do bad policy, if you like. The role of monetary policy is to keep the economy steady and keep inflation from getting up, price stability we sometimes call. So that's what they should do. Every time they've tried to do these other things, if you like, help out fiscal policy, try to focus on the unemployment rate, it has made things worse. And that's the concern I have right now.
All right. Segment four, first principles. From your latest book, First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity, paperback coming in May, the American vision was that the economic decisions American people would make would be made within, now we get to the five first principles, a predictable government policy framework based on the rule of law with strong incentives derived from the market system and with a clearly limited role for government, close quote. Now let's take each of those in turn. Predictability. Why does that matter?
Because people want to know what the rules of the game are. They want to know what the tax rates are going to be. They don't want to be afraid that there's going to be a big change in the tax rates every year. They want to know what the Federal Reserve is going to do to keep the economy stable. They want to know that there's not going to be a surprise, if you like. On fiscal policy, they don't want something that's temporary. They don't know what's next. All those things make it very hard to make decisions.
And if you had to
make commitments, if you like.
If you had to weight the different factors between the rapid recovery of the 80s and the sluggish recovery we're experiencing now, how much weight would you give the predictability of policy in the 80s versus the unpredictability of policies today?
Well, it's a significant weight. I personally put a lot of emphasis on predictability compared to a lot of other things. So I would put it a high weight. I mentioned there's other things involved, but I would put that a high weight. And I emphasize that because many people forget about predictability. Mm. They think about incentives, which you mentioned already. Think about markets, limited role for government. But predictability is key. And when policy has been more predictable, the economy has done better. And we saw that not just in the 80s, but in the 90s until recently.
So if you and I were let's just make you alone, were a dictator for 24 hours beginning tomorrow, charged with reinvigorating the principle of predictability, what would be the first one or two things the United States government ought to do?
Well, first of all, it would be a contradiction to think about predictability being put in forth through a dictatorial means. It's completely contrary to what predictability would be. It's in a democracy, you put in policy, you know, in a way that's not going to be changed.
All I can say is thank goodness I'm not your grad student.
So what you have to do is, if you take budget policy, you lay out a long-term plan for the budget, you deliberate about it, and you come up with it. Your tax reform, you have a tax reform, you put that in place. Entitlement reform, you put that in place. Monetary policy, you follow a rule. There's a whole wide range of things. In a democracy, you have to work towards that. It doesn't come overnight, and you make the case for it. And that's what we're
doing. Does Bill Clinton get high marks in this regard? He made some adjustments. Yes. He raised taxes somewhat, but he effectively ratified the underlying economic program that Reagan had been put in place and that George H.W. Bush continued. Is that right?
In many, many respects, it's right. Of course, during his time, you had a monetary policy that stayed to the, got rid of the stop-go. It was kind of a smooth, focused monetary policy. There weren't a lot of stimulus packages. We didn't talk about that. We had the welfare reform, which was limiting the role of the federal government. That was under Clinton administration. Well, the Congress had a big part of that, but if you look in terms of presidential terms, it was more or less a continuation.
Principle, the second big principle you mentioned, rule of law. You don't mean to suggest that President Obama and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke have wandered away from this basic tenet of American life, the rule of law, do you?
Well, you know, the interventions going into the panic period, remember we bailed out the creditors of Bear Stearns. There were questions about interpreting the law, if you like that, which I think some people questioned, even Paul Volcker questioned it at that point. When during the Chrysler bailout, some creditors went ahead, other creditors, which would not have taken place, I think, if you followed the rule of law in a straightforward way from the bankruptcy code. There are special favors given, obviously, in certain cases. That questions the rule of law. So I would say what economists have learned over the years that the rule of law is very important in terms of a market economy working well. And if you get away from that, you're going to really run into problems, and that's the concern.
That's why I
put it forth as a principle.
I asked a provocative question and tried to get you to launch an attack on President Obama or Ben Bernanke, but let me ask this question.
Yeah.
The way this town of Washington works, if you're a corporation with any money at stake, you hire a lobbyist and you try to get a loophole enacted. Is that kind of activity, legal though it is in a strict sense, is that kind of activity inimical to what you understand as the rule of law, equal treatment for
similarly
placed players?
Yeah, I think those are cases where it becomes questionable. I would give an example where you have a regulated industry and there's people responsible for regulating, say, the risks in the banks. And for some reason, they don't enforce those rules. Fannie and Freddie is an example where this occurred. Obviously, it was a lot of lobbying, a lot of other things going on, but there were rules which were not enforced, and that's the kind of thing you worry about. The rule of law is really not being followed because people are getting away either because of special favors or because of the inability of the regulators to follow the law. We call this regulatory capture sometimes. The industry gets captured. The industry captures the regulators.
All right. Incentives, another of your principles. Again, explain this.
Well, incentives are all over the place. What you want to do is think about the price system. Prices go up, people will buy less if you move into another product. And so the price system comes out of the markets, and that provides incentives for people to allocate resources properly, to get the education that's appropriate. So the incentives are what makes the economy work well. Resources go where they're supposed to go. And when you forget about incentives, maybe give incentives for people that don't work anymore. They have incentives not to work. Sometimes the new health care law, for example, will give subsidies for people to get insurance which goes up to, say, $90,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, and then it cuts off, and so there's a disincentive to increase your income in that case.
What about
those are the incentives?
What about the incentives that actors in the political system face? What about the incentive of a politician to effectively to buy votes? Reward this or that group with a constituency group or this or that special interest with money raised on the backs of other taxpayers. Is there some way of, we're stuck with that one?
Well, we're stuck with incentives, let's face it. Incentives are, that's what motivates people. That's what you want, the incentives to be used in a constructive way. You want the incentives for people to do the right thing, not for them to do the wrong thing. But incentives exist in the political system. I think you want to have a system which is simple, if you like, so people can't exploit it. And that's one of the reasons to keep the regulations simple. So
what about tax reform? Is that
same kind of thing. The complicated tax code gives all sorts of examples for people to, instead of to spend time in work, spend time in study, they spend time filling out their tax form. That's a disincentive.
Right. The market system. We want free markets. So let me add, this is the fourth of your principles. As I mentioned, under President Obama, federal spending has gone from about 21% of GDP right up to, it's a little under 25% now. Does that 4%, is that in some way or other a more or less direct index of a shift away from a market system? Is federal spending...
It's only part. It's part of it, because some of that is activity that the private sector might have been doing just as well. But the government's role in the economy goes well beyond what you'd measure by spending. It's the regulations, if you like, sort of, or it's most egregiously price controls, quantity controls, price controls. In part of my book, I emphasize how President Nixon imposed wage and price controls on the whole economy, sort of overriding the market system in many respects. In modern times now, we have the Federal Reserve, which has really dominated the short-term end of the market, almost replaced the short-term borrowing and lending money market with itself. That's another example where the market's being suppressed. So there's many examples besides that are not measured just by the total amount of spending.
The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is that a suppression of market? Of the market system, or an adjust? How do you understand that?
Yes, I think it is, because here the government is telling people what kind of insurance to get. It's a mandate. Obviously, a mandate is not something you're just letting the markets or people decide themselves. And plus, it's a mandate to buy a particular product.
All right. Limited role for government. Once again, explain limited role for government. Why is this a fundamental principle?
What I teach my students, freshmen, first-year students, is when you're thinking about the role for government, you want to do a cost-benefit analysis. Certain things the government can do, there's externalities of pollution. You should have some controls on how much is polluted. There's education, because an externality, you want the government maybe to take a role in subsidizing some of that education. So you want to think about what the benefits and the costs are and come up to a decision based on that. And it's usually pretty limited, because the market can do so many things better than the government can do. That's what you mean by limited. It's sensibly deciding when the government has a role and when it doesn't.
Now, if even Ronald Reagan couldn't get rid of the Department of Education, and if even Margaret Thatcher never had the temerity to talk about privatizing the National Health Service, aren't you, fine man that you are, aren't you just on the wrong side of history on this question of limited government? Doesn't seven decades of perpetual, constant expansion tell us that that is just the way things are in the modern world? Or do you actually see an opportunity to assert this principle and somehow scale back? What are you up to? You want to slow the growth?
There's a number of things you can look at to see progress. One thing in terms of education, there's a lot more use of the choice, charter schools, vouchers in the U.S. It's growing. His reports are quite impressive. So that's going in the other direction. You can see some examples. Remember, I mentioned this conversation how in the 1990s, some of the welfare decisions were moved out of the federal government to the states.
Right.
That's another issue about the role of government. It seemed very productive. We have use of the market more, even in the prescription drug program that was put in place. People got to choose what kind
Medicare
of...
Medicare Part D.
So I think there are examples, but you're correct. In fact, we're now, I'd say, in a phase where we've swung away from these principles. I'd say, it seemed to me, it's a back-and-forth thing. In the 70s, I mentioned wage and price controls, and better interventionist policies. And then in the 80s and 90s, we moved back, less regulation, if you like, welfare reform, a more steady-as-you-go monetary policy and fiscal policy, more emphasis on markets and predictability. And now I'm afraid we've drifted back again. And the results are pretty clear to me. We're having a weak economy. We've had high unemployment. And that's, I think, the major fact that it's going on here.
All right. You just touched on what to me is one of the most perplexing questions of all. During the Reagan years, you get set in place a regime of relatively low tax rates. The 86 tax reform simplifies the tax system, relatively limited regulation. He supports Volcker's stable monetary growth. And Clinton, in effect, ratifies most of the Reagan program. With what result? A quarter of a century of economic growth, utterly unprecedented in human history. It had never happened before in human history that a nation this large had grown that much for that long. And now here we are saying all of those policies, toss them over the side, let's inflate the currency, expand the... Why is this the case? And it's not as if the politicians have come along and said, no, let's not listen to the lessons of these economists anymore. It's your own profession. The Keynesian impulse, not only did it not die, but it's almost as though there's a kind of inability to learn from that quarter century.
Yeah, you're making very good points. I write about this in my book. One of the biggest questions is why this occurs. And I think part of it is political, it's learning. Think of it this way. By the end of the 1970s, people were sick of this, the high unemployment, the inflation. Right. They could see this got to change. But then maybe after a couple of plus decades, people got complacent. They forgot why things were going so well. So they started to move and do these different things, and now things are going bad. So I believe we'll have a switch back again. And maybe this time it will not be.
So each generation has to learn how bad things can get?
It looks like, I don't know if it's generation, Peter, but it takes some time. From the late 60s to the end of the 70s, is about 15 years before we learned. And there were people out there like Milton Friedman writing about it constantly. And eventually it changed. And things were much better for a while. Not perfect. I don't think we went far enough. Basically, it was disappointing. By the time things switched, we could have done a lot more.
All right. The economy's sluggish. We've gone into that in great detail. We've got this slow rate of growth. Although technically recovery begins in 2009, and here we are years afterwards, unemployment is still 8% or higher. However, Silicon Valley continues to work its magic. Google is about to announce this wild new computer system that you wear in your eyeglasses. Many sectors in agriculture are booming, particularly with exports to China and India. We've got hydraulic fracturing transforming energy in this country. The price of energy, we're producing so much natural gas that the industry is studying where they're going to be exporting energy from the United States to abroad. So I put it to you that there is a possibility that the economy is so resilient that we will be able to afford lousy policies ad infinitum, and the economy will still tick right along and grow pretty well. And what's wrong with 2% growth anyway?
Well, I certainly hope you're right that we get fast growth because of all these things. But if it's 2%, that would be a tremendous disappointment.
So let me put it
this way. If all those things you mentioned led us to have 4% growth for a while to pick up our trend to get the unemployment rate down, that would be wonderful. And this is a great country. There are people here all the time doing great inventions. And by the way, some of the factors you mentioned in your sentence was exports, basically emerging markets. Are doing well, they've actually come to follow some of the principles while we've moved away from them. So you have these factors that are very promising, I think. But quite frankly, I think if we don't change the policy, we will have this 2% growth, and it is very disappointing. It's hardly enough to have incomes rise over time. The notion of progress and the notion of people being able to move from the lower income distributions to the higher
part
goes away.
So 4% growth means America as we understand it. It means that it's reasonable to suppose that we can assimilate large numbers of immigrants. It's reasonable to suppose that for my generation, for my children's generation, that subsequent generations will be able to do better than their parents. It's reasonable to suppose that we'll continue to have quite a great deal of income, mobility, people able to climb up from wherever they started. That's what 4% means. And 2% means 2% means what?
It means we struggle along. Kids are having trouble finding jobs even if they go to college.
High youth
unemployment.
It's worse
if you don't go to college. It's high unemployment. It's longer term unemployment. It's we don't have enough resources to do the things we want to do, even government or in the private sector. It's actually stagnation in many respects. It's hardly keeping up with the growth of the labor force, even without the immigration.
So to go back to that chart with which we started, that potential GDP is America that we understand. The real GDP is...
It's this languishing. It's not catching up.
All
it's
right.
Whole, it's staying
and
beyond.
So we must... This notion that this is the new normal, that's just unacceptable to you.
To me. And it's disappointing that people might want to think that's enough.
All right. Last question. The president, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, they've made up their minds about what they're going to do on economics. 45 Republicans in the Senate, a Republican majority in the House. They're not in the executive branch. They get to talk. They get to cast votes. Is there any economic good as we shoot here in Washington today that you can counsel the 45 Republicans in the Senate and the Republican majority in the House to attempt? Can they do any good?
Absolutely. As we talk, there's discussions about the budget and the sequester and how to hold that urge to intervene, urge to spend back. So by resisting that and arguing there's a better way, we still have a problem in this economy. This unemployment rate is too high. Your policies are making it worse. First of all, they do have the ability to make changes on the fiscal side with, say, holding the line, if you like, on the spending. They have the power to do that if they can stick with it. So it's very important, especially right now, I think, because we have to get out of this funk we're in at this point. So I think it's a great role. And ultimately, what they do will affect people's views of the success of policies. Remember, Peter, we had 15 years of this from the late 60s and the 70s, and it was both parties. Some did a better job than others. So to me, this is something that we're going to be able to deal with, but you can't be complacent. You can't sit back and let who's ever in charge do whatever they want.
I said that was the last question. I lied. This is the last question. You're at Stanford. I said, thank goodness I'm not your graduate student because I'm not bright enough to be your graduate
That's
student.
Wrong.
But what do you notice among rising members of the economics profession now, among your grad students, for example? Do you see this attraction to Keynesianism or neo-Keynesian? I noticed, Googling around to prepare for this interview, I noticed that the phrase now is neo-Keynesian. Keynesianism, which apparently insulates
well, there's
the
neo, there's new, there's a million, so, new
but,
neo,
but
new, new.
So within the profession, where's the action? Where's the intellectual action of the economics profession?
In my students, generally as students, I don't see this move towards the Keynesian approach. The models we have been teaching and are still being developed do not support a lot of these policies. In many respects, the models that were used to justify them were old-fashioned models. It goes back to your question, how could possibly people have forgotten and use these models. But what we teach our graduate students, for the most part, what they're doing research on, is not based on these. It's really based on these principles, if you like, of economic freedom. They might put it a different way. They're certainly focused on incentives. There's a lot of change, a lot of foreign students coming to study in the United States with their new ideas. They may be coming from Latin America, from Europe, or from Asia. They have different views of system. They're not wedded into, if you like, old-fashioned Keynesianism, or even new neo, whatever you call it, Keynesianism. So it's promising.
John, first principles, I should stress, is beautifully written for the layman, which means, and I know the test is, if I was able to understand every word, and I was, it's written for the layman, a wonderful book. John Taylor, author of First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity, out in paperback this May. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Peter Robinson for Uncommon Knowledge. Thanks for joining us.